Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
This is the Radical Gardening Edition. I'm Alex Smith, returning to our conversation with Chris Tomlinson, the Gorilla Gardener of Love. He tells us how to convert waste space into perennial sources of food in the UK or wherever you live. In the big picture, Chris, our city seems so purposely hostile, not just to nature, but even to the citizens. We pave over as much as we can to save maintenance costs, and then we plant the most boring ground cover and trees with no possible help for the population. How did we get into such a situation, do you think?
I think it's all from the mass consumerist drive that we're on, and hence the occupations happening across the globe. And I'd just like to say here, I think Gorilla Gardeners have been doing occupations a lot longer than these Johnny-come-latelys tear up, put me out of the block. And we do permanent occupations once you put a tree in. If it gets left alone, that's my little occupation, I suppose. But getting back to your question was, I suppose people have come disconnected from the environment around them. And it's quite sad. It saddens me in my heart. But as soon as you touch that soil, like I have, because I had a breakdown a little while ago and threw things quite down about life. Gardening actually saved me, and I'd recommend it to anyone if they want to reconnect. Just get yourself a packet of seeds and take an allotment plot. It's not I'm against anything either. I'm in favour of anyone doing any form of growing, you know, all power to their elbows.
Well, you're not the first one who's been saved by gardening, I have to tell you that. You know, when I was in Morocco, the avenues were lined with orange trees. Everyone had free oranges. Is there any sign the UK is beginning to rethink this ban on creating an edible landscape?
Well, I think that's because of Transition Towns. Rob Hoskins, what he's done is fantastic. I just met him in the St Paul's occupation the other day and shook his hand and said, respect, keep it going, Mr Hoskins. I think there is a big awakening going on. And as someone said when I was staying in a Radical Roots co-op in England, gardening has become trendy and unbelievable, but it is. To try and get an allotment plot, you have to be on a very long waiting list now. So there is a resurgence. There's a big change going on the planet at the moment.
What kind of feedback are you getting, if you'll pardon the pun? Have you heard from others around the UK or around the world?
Because I regularly check Richard Reynolds' website, www.gorillagardening.org. That covers anyone can sort of send things in, and he'll have videos on there, and that's kind of our sort of international touch line to see what's going on out there.
Great. Well, we've been talking with Chris Tomlinson from the UK. He's been busy planting food in the cities of Britain as the founder of this group, Gorillas of Love, which turns out to be mainly him, but there's lots of others following your lead, I'm sure. Thank you so much, Chris, and thank you for what you do.
Thanks very much, Alex. All power to anyone for any change in the world. We need it. Thanks.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. You are tuned to the Radical Gardening Show on Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex. I've got my getaway garden in a lovely hot spot. But will it be too hot to grow our food? In a few minutes, we'll tell you more about how to set up a winter garden, even in cold weather climates. But first, listen to this YouTube report from an organic grower in Austin, Texas, during last summer's record drought and heat wave. I expected a quick tour of barren, caked-out land, but the uploader, calling himself Humpty Dumpty Tribe, kept the camera on a green and flourishing garden. Why?
This is, you know, my organic garden. I got it in late this year. I didn't get it in until the middle of April, so I was about a month late getting the garden in. I admit that was a lot of this is my fault. So I planted it late and put in my tomatoes and peppers and everything, and so the garden grew absolutely beautifully. It grew beautifully. The plants are beautiful, all full of blooms. The little honeybees, they're, you know, going around doing all their pollinating and stuff. So I've got beautiful plants, full of blooms, full of honeybees. Everything is going along rosy. But I've noticed that the plants are not setting any fruit. I won't say none, but very few fruit. And I go, what is going on? And so I finally figured it out after Googling and studying that it's simply a matter of it's too damn hot. And it is, you know, it's June 8th and already for days and days already, it has been triple digits in Austin, Texas. As I say, this is the hottest summer we have ever experienced. So in every day, it's been, you know, 100 damn degrees, and the low at night has been like 75 to 77 degrees. Well, if you Google poor fruit set on tomatoes, for instance, you will find out that the reason for poor fruit set are temperatures. And it says when the temperatures are steadily above 85 degrees during the day, and they're steadily above 85 degrees during the day, and more importantly, when the temperatures don't get below 68 degrees at night, that plants don't set fruit. They just don't set fruit. And so I will show you a classic example of this. So right here, these beautiful tomatoes. Now this is just on the same plant. Look at all these tomatoes now. They're not ripened yet. These are mostly beefsteaks. These tomatoes, we put these plants in, you know, right around the 1st of April. This is a dozen plants, but you notice they're all down here. They all set fruit very early in the season, and there has been no fruit set since. So here's what we've got in this garden right in front of your eyes to demonstrate this famine. So this row of tomatoes was put in around the 1st of April. Now we were really lax on the second row of tomatoes, so we did not get these tomatoes in for about 3 weeks later. So we put our second row of tomatoes in. This is 9 tomato plants, these big beautiful beefsteak tomato plants. 9 tomato plants. We have 1 tomato off of 9 plants. The plants are beautiful. They're full of blooms, as you can see, and they're setting no fruit out of 9 plants, which we should be getting about probably at least 100, if not 150 tomatoes. We have 1 tomato. This is because the temperature by the 1st of June is where the temperature in August in Austin, Texas is usually by the middle of July or the 1st of August. It is so damn hot. Now, and look at these watermelons and cantaloupes. I mean, they're full of blooms. I mean, look at it. You can see the honeybees going all around them. They're absolutely gorgeous plants. Setting all these blooms, we should be getting out of this gorgeous melon bed. This is cantaloupes and watermelons. We should get, I figured, about 100 cantaloupes and about 50 watermelons. So far, I have found 5 cantaloupes and 1 watermelon so far that are forming. Same story with these absolutely gorgeous pole beans. I should have picked well more than a bushel of beans. They're full of blooms. The plants are beautiful. They're blooming. There's no bean setting. There's just no fruit setting. So here you go, guys. Here is a tremendous effect on the food supply directly related to record-breaking hot temperatures in Austin, Texas. Now, you know, I'm just gardening. This is more of a hobby than anything, but if I was depending on my food for myself and my family and my friends, my tribe, and we were depending on this garden to feed us, we would starve. It is that simple. We're getting about max 20% of the food that we, I would say there is an 80 to 90% crop loss. 80 to 90% crop loss right here in South Austin, Texas, in one garden because of global warming and climate change. is the fact that Austin, Texas is having its single hottest summer in history, hottest and driest spring and summer in history, is that related to the fact that in the year 2010, more greenhouse gases were dumped into the planet Earth's atmosphere than in any year in history? I don't know. Sounds like pretty good circumstantial evidence to me. And so, when these climate change fear-mongers start talking about global-wide famines in 20 to 50 years because, you know, we just won't be bringing the food in, and people laugh about that, guys, it's no laughing matter. Right here in Austin, Texas, here it is in living color, proof that famine is on its way. Famine is on its way, and I am on my way to Ecuador to get about 6,000-7,000 feet up the Andes Mountains, so I don't need to deal with this 100 degrees every day from here as far as it can see. Bye, guys.
That was a YouTube report from Austin, Texas, posted by Humpty Dumpty Tribe. Find the link in my blog at ecoshock.info. And now the inside dope on growing food in the depths of winter without extra heating.
This is Walter Garrison, the host of Locavore on CFRU 93.3 FM. And thank you very much for coming and tuning into our show today, Thursday, January 27th. Today we're going to be talking about season extension, and we're going to be talking to a very interesting man, Martin Rona, who's been doing work at the Guelph Center for Urban Organic Farming on season extension and growing crops in the winter time. It's a very interesting topic, season extension, something we really don't think about that much. Quite frankly, it's something that we don't do enough of. And in fact, there's a great opportunity to do a lot more with respect to growing crops in the late fall, in the early winter, and throughout the winter and into the spring. Now, one of the pioneers in season extension is a gentleman by the name of Elliot Coleman. And anybody that's been involved in the local agriculture movement or the organic movement would know Elliot Coleman's name quite well. He used to have a show on the Learning Channel called Gardening Naturally with he and his partner, Barbara Damrosch, who herself is a noted author in the field of horticulture. And they have a farm in Maine near the Penobscot Bay, which they have used to grow vegetables and produce year-round. It's really very interesting what they've done that far north as far as growing food for themselves. They've built, over the last several years, a thriving business as producers and purveyors of excellent winter vegetables, which they raise without major inputs of heat, extra light, or growth-promoting chemicals. And the key to their business can be summed up in three words: organic, local, and authentic. And what they have done really sort of sets what we as consumers of produce in the wintertime eat on its head, actually. Coleman talks about Americans having grown to depend on winter crops from California and Florida. He talks about the U.S. building highways and transport systems to get them to market in the north, and water being subsidized for irrigation. And it's, quite frankly, U.S. taxpayers that are subsidizing this. If you know, for example, the first name of the farmer that you deal with, then the food you buy can be labeled authentic. It may not be organic, but certainly it can be labeled as authentic. You know, it's very interesting when you look at it. When we look at latitude, and Martin's going to talk about this today, if you look at a place like Maine, Maine has the same latitude as Saint-Tropez. So Saint-Tropez, for example, and Maine get the same amount of winter daylight, and daylight is just as important as temperature. And Coleman's found that in southern France and northern Italy, locally raised crops are exactly what people expect to find in their market any time of year. And I guess when we look at local crops, we have to look at selecting winter hardy vegetables. And that is the first challenge. And the second challenge is, once you've selected those plants, is to protect them from severe freezes in the wintertime. And that involves using plastic greenhouses that arch above rows and maybe row covers as well, too. It's something that on the surface would appear to be a costly initiative, but actually growing crops in tunnels is actually economical. And if you look at a 3,000 square foot greenhouse now, in this is U.S. dollars and states cost, it cost them $6,000 to put up. So 3,000 square feet, $6,000 to put up, that's $2 a square foot. Try and find a house for $2 a square foot. We're looking at costs, housing costs being, I would say anywhere from $100, $125, $150 a square foot to start. So looking at a greenhouse to grow vegetables for yourself, that works out to about $2 a square foot, at least down in Maine. And hopefully they hope to gross about $100,000 a year growing greenhouse crops. You can do that. I think you'd be well on the way to sustaining yourself. So who would they sell to? Well, they'd sell to local markets and to local chefs. And looking at something like, for example, golden and deep red beets accompanying locally raised salmon at a restaurant, you know, salad greens, fennel leeks accompanying a leg of lamb, radishes, baby carrots, things that you don't expect to find produced and harvested fresh in the wintertime. It's quite possible. Coleman wrote a book called Four Season Harvest, which is probably the seminal book on season extension and what is possible, at least for us that live in northern climates. So I highly recommend that book. Check it out. Now, we're going to do an interview today with Martin Rona, who's been working, helping out at the Guelph Center for Urban Organic Farming. And what Martin's done is he's worked on growing winter vegetables in a greenhouse under row covers. So we're going to be talking with Martin today about what he's done with respect to producing vegetables in the wintertime. I wanted to ask about the future and what you see for initiatives that may be done with respect to the season extension work that's being done at the Guelph Center for Urban Organic Farming.
Well, I think part of the future could be, you know, involving students more and doing research here and reaching out to the community, showing people that they can make fairly simple structures. As the hoop house that I built outside, they could easily build that in their backyard and grow lots of food locally, fresh, in their backyard. It's not that hard. It actually does work. It doesn't sound like it will work, but it actually does. And so we could have workshops involving people of the community to teach people that it's quite a feasible thing to grow fresh vegetables in your backyard in the winter.
So I'm standing in the middle of the greenhouse here at the GCUOF, and I see we have several beds in here with straw in between the beds. We have row covers over the beds and support systems for these row covers in order to have vegetables grow over the wintertime. It's December 2nd today, and it's quite warm in here. Well, it's actually a lot cooler outside. So, Martin, could you go over how the greenhouse itself was prepared for in-ground growing and the greenhouse structure itself?
Okay, the structure is a large metal frame with two layers of plastic that are inflated. Well, actually, one half is. The other half isn't working so well now, but we'll work on that. And then inside, when I first came here, the ground was hard as a brick. It was like soil that had been compacted while it was wet during the construction of the frame. So it was pretty much useless for anything. And I spent about 3 to 4 months, about 3 hours a day, digging with a shovel to turn this into usable soil and adding large amounts of wood chip rich, mineral-rich compost from outdoors, and now we have very nice soil in here. Yeah, with our inflatable plastic structure and our inner layer of floating row covers, we should be able to maintain these plants in here all winter long, even at minus 25 degrees. They may look a little iffy for a few days, but when the sun comes back, they'll all spring back to life again.
This is Radio EcoShock. You're listening to an interview with Martin Rona with Walter Garrison of The Locavore Show.
So the next step when we look at a season extension is the greenhouse structure itself. And in this next segment, Martin's going to talk about the greenhouse structure and how it's set up and how it works. So let's take a walk around the greenhouse, and I just want to discuss some of the structural aspects of it with you. Mm-hmm. We have the support system here, and we have a side rail along the support system, and we have, is it fiberglass on either end or polycarbonate?
That's polycarbonate.
Polycarbonate, okay. And how is it inflated? Could you describe the system for that?
Well, we have a very long extension cord that goes to the parking lot temporarily, and we're plugged into a light post. That comes through the extension cord into the greenhouse. We have two small blowers that run continuously. That inflates our greenhouse. We should be getting a solar panel system this week, 1 kilowatt of solar energy, and that should power all our systems here. But because of the weather, this year's been kind of wet this fall, so the installation company has been a little delayed, and we're hoping that they'll begin soon. And we're going to have a small house built with batteries, inverters, and everything, and we can still run everything off the same at 120 volt, so that if the solar system, for whatever reason, goes down, we can still always use the extension cord to the parking lot method. But we hope to be off the grid.
With respect to the well and water and irrigation, are you irrigating at all in the wintertime or not?
No, most of these plants, once the soil's moist, it stays moist, and it probably will stay moist, probably till things start growing again. Plants in here don't really grow from about 6 weeks before and after the winter solstice, so everything just goes, it grows imperceptibly or it becomes dormant, so it needs very little water. Once we get into the second week of February and the day length gets long enough, usually the day length has to be more than 10 hours for plants to grow. So it's the latitude that's important, not the temperature. And that's quite counterintuitive to most people. I think it's too cold to grow things here. But it's not. We have the same latitude as southern France. And they grow vegetables outside in southern France without any greenhouses. Mind you, they have a warmer climate. But we have the same day length. And often during winters, we have more sunlight than they do. So it's perfectly feasible to grow things here.
I wanted to ask you about when you think the ideal planting time is. When would you start planting for season extension to grow underneath the greenhouse and underneath row covers? What's the interval between plantings you'd use, and when would you stop planting?
Okay, I would start, if this was my greenhouse and it was up to me, I would start planting in probably the beginning of August with carrots and beets and things like that, root crops. The end of August, I would start planting my greens. And I would probably stop planting by the end of September. And I'd maybe leave a week between plantings, or 2 weeks, just to get some succession crops going. Unfortunately, this year I was a bit late, but I was constrained by having the summer crops in here. Or next year we can have a compromise between summer and winter crops.
That's interesting because it certainly puts the idea of planting and harvesting on its head. It spins at 180 degrees because you're actually very actively planting in August and September in preparation to have food available for you for the next several months.
Oh, yes. We want to stock our outdoor refrigerator.
Basically, just before winter solstice, if, I guess 6 weeks before, that is when you're going to end planting. And he talked about successional planting. So essentially, you could start in late August and start seeding, for example, carrots and seed them every 2 weeks. And then if you think winter solstice is going to be December 21st, you might want to plant every 2 weeks up till, let's say, about November 8th, something like that. So it's quite possible to have a successional harvest of greens, of root crops, following this method. Okay, now we're going to actually get into what crops Martin is working with at the GCUOF. I'd like to ask about the crops that you're growing here, when you planted them, and why you chose these specific crops to grow here.
Okay, well, most of the crops I've grown here we know are winter hardy. Kale, mizuna, well, there's two types of kale, Bordeaux spinach, arugula, red oak lettuce, cold hardy spinach, nice mesclun mixture, mustard greens, all kinds of things that have traditionally been used in for winter gardens, at least for fall and spring gardens, but they all manage through the winter as well. Another reason I chose some of these crops, because they're the only seeds I could scrounge.
Okay, so necessity.
Yeah, necessity. Yeah. And then at one point, I did go to William Dam Seeds, and I bought some Asian green seeds. Unfortunately, I planted some of my crops a bit too late, because the summer crops were still in here. We wanted to keep them till Thanksgiving, so that we could have our last big sale, then remove the summer crops. So there's some beds that I managed to plant at the end of August, and they're doing very well. They're quite mature. There's other crops that I didn't plant till the mid-October. But surprisingly, they're actually almost mature, which I didn't expect. And then there's some that I planted that are still very small. That was October 25th was my last planting of Asian greens. So they've sort of gone into a state of dormancy, and by mid-February they should start to grow. And by end of February, early March, we should have a nice crop. So I have plants in all different stages of succession in here as well. Apparently plants that are quite mature, fairly large, don't do as well with cold temperature. They succumb to stress more easily. Plants that are teenagers are a lot tougher. They can withstand more winter stresses and bounce back more easily. We have everything from very small to sort of mid-sized to almost mature plants. So we should have some good food to last us all winter and right till our outdoor spring crops.
Have you tried any of the crops that have been growing underneath the greenhouse and in the tunnels here at all?
Oh, yes. Last night I had a delicious dinner of mesclun with some arugula and some lettuce. Within a half an hour of cutting it, I brought it home and had a lovely, delicious salad. It's very satisfying to have something that's fresh, that's local, that you've grown yourself. And because of all those reasons, it's very precious. You don't want to waste it, and you really enjoy it to the full.
What are other challenges that you've found that you've had to deal with in season extension?
One small challenge, I guess, is the meadow voles, a chipmunk, and a great many mice. But fortunately, there's a weasel that lives here. I've seen him entering the greenhouse as I'm leaving in the evening. He's actually done a very good job on the meadow voles. In the corner, actually, I dug my own little pit. I put in a 5-gallon plastic pail, put in some wheat or some grains, and meadow voles love that little trap. They all hop in there, and then when they're stuck in there and can't get out, along comes the weasel and has a little treat. The first little while, I was just using a watering can. I have quite a few rain barrels that I brought in here, black rain barrels that I filled up with water, which help absorb sunlight and keep the temperature fairly mild in here. At this point, I'm not watering at all. I probably won't have to water until, if we get a week of sunny weather, I might, and it gets quite warm in here. If, for example, if it was a nice, bright, sunny day all day today, and it was zero outside, it might be 15 or 18 in here. With the row covers on, that prevents some of the evaporation, but if plants aren't growing, there's not a lot of evapotranspiration happening. So, yeah, we could probably get away without watering for quite a long time. So the water barrels there now are doing a different job. They're just trying to act as a heat sink. And then later on, when things start to perk up in mid-February, then I'll have to start using them as a water source for the plants again.
Has anybody done any research for either the ambient air temperature underneath the row covers or the soil temperature underneath the row covers?
Again, I would love to do that if I had the equipment. But at this point, you know, I'm just looking after things, trying to make sure everything grows. And I just like to act as a support person for people who want to do projects. If there's students that would need extra help, I'd be glad to help them out. Or if people want to do doctorate studies, I'd be glad to act as a support for them. Yeah, there's lots of interesting research that could be done with this facility.
My thanks to Walter Garrison and the Locavore Show from the nonprofit campus and community radio station CFRU-FM at the University of Guelph, Canada. Find links to the full program in the Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. We are totally out of time. I'm Alex Smith. Our website is ecoshock.org. You heard a bit of background from Vast Mandana. Thank you for listening. Start your food insurrection, your own food bank, if you will. Plan your planting.